Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
I'm Mike Shackelford.
Our guest tonight will be one of my heroes, Stanford Wong. The book we're going to be talking about is called Sharp Sports Betting, and it's one that has made my co-host a lot of money. We'll be talking to Wong about a quarter past the hour. Mike, there's a new casino opening up soon in Atlantic City. This casino impresses you very much. Why is that?
This casino impresses me very much because they're going to be completely non-smoking. I am a very strong advocate of smoke-free casinos, so I have to applaud the Revel for having the guts to go non-smoking.
Well, I'm strongly in favor of non-smoking as well, but I don't think the non-smoking rule is going to last. Mike and I are working on the parameters of a $100 bet about non-smoking at the Revel. I think our final decision was that by the end of 2013, if smoking is allowed in at least half of the casino area at the Revel, I win $100. And if it isn't, he wins $100. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding, and I agree to those terms.
All right, it's official. We may ask one of our listeners to tell us what the conditions are, because I suspect neither Mike nor I are going to spend quite a bit more than $100 just to go back and see if we want a $100 bet. I personally am a non-smoker and wish casinos were non-smoking places, very much so. But casinos have tried this over and over again and have come to the conclusion that it doesn't work. Smoking, drinking, gambling, overeating are all destructive habits. And people with one of these destructive habits usually have more than one. The biggest losers at gambling are predominantly smokers. Not allowing them to smoke at your casino when there are many other casinos close by means that the other casino will be doing a lot more business than you will. So while my heart and lungs wish casinos were non-smoking places, I think the smarts bets the other way.
I have to agree that this has been tried before, and as far as I know, every casino that has tried going non-smoking either changed their minds or went out of business. And I'm not saying that the Revel is going to be non-smoking forever. I hope they do, but I'm really hoping they give it the old college try and go at least 2 years with this. So please stick with it, guys. And times are tough in Atlantic City. And just because things may not be great right after you first open doesn't necessarily mean that it's the smoking is the problem. And maybe there is room in the market for just one non-smoking casino in Atlantic City. And furthermore, when this was tried in Vegas at the, what was it called, the Silver City or the Silver Slipper, that was just that place was a dump.
Yes,
and
it was.
And I don't think that, I think they would have failed either way.
Okay, we shall see. Maybe you should plead with them that for the sake of your $100 bet, they should keep to make their decision. What do you think? Think that'll work?
I don't think they're going to care about that, but I hope that they stay non-smoking much more because I think it's the right thing to do than because of the bet.
All right, moving on. We received an email from Jamie in Texas. He wants to know if being an advantage video poker player is as easy or hard as finding a good game and memorizing a strategy card. Well, that's part of it. There are considerations such as evaluating and extracting full value from promotions, maintaining your welcome, not getting burnout, getting and keeping a bankroll, among other things. Many people who try to be advantage players at any game are unsuccessful. Every successful advantage player does it a little bit differently than every other one. Shaq and I do not operate the same way. And neither of us operate the way Munchkin did or the way Frank Nealon did. Every one of us is different. Every successful player today does it differently than he did 2 years ago. And if you want to be part of this, come on in, give it a try. But you should have a plan B in place. Any comment on this, Mike?
I agree with you 100%. There's no easy way to make a lot of money as a professional gambler. And there's lots of different ways it can be done. But in my opinion, they're all hard. And I think that you have to keep learning, and you have to develop relationships with other professional gamblers to learn new information. And no, it's... I don't want to say that it's... I don't want to overblow it. It's hard, but it's still very doable. To change the subject, there was one question that was on our list from last week with Shirley Dancer that we didn't have time to ask, but let me ask you.
Okay.
Do you guys have a prenuptial agreement?
Yes and no. Or actually, yes, we do, but it is no longer in effect. When we got married, I had substantially more income, more wealth than she did. Although it turned out we were both hiding wealth from the other at the time. And so the deal is, if she left me during the first year, I would get 95% of the joint assets and she would get 5%. If she left me in the second year, it would be 90-10. In the third year, it would be 85-15. Except if she lasted 10 years, then it would be 50-50 and stay that way. So it's been over 10 years, so it is 50-50. So the prenup, while it is still there, is no longer relevant. It turns out it wouldn't be relevant anyway, basically, because our wealth exploded after we got married, so that part would be all 50-50 anyway. But prenups are really only necessary if you're going to divorce. And then, depending on how polite the divorce is. Now, I'm not foreseeing any kind of divorce, but if it happened maybe that Shirley met some guy at church and she felt the next 20 years of her life would be better spent with a Christian than a gambler, and it wasn't that I had done anything particularly wrong, then I suspect we could reach a property settlement in an hour or two and go about our separate ways. If I don't think that's going to happen, but you never know. If, on the other hand, she discovered that I had fallen for a 27-year-old stripper and had been seeing this younger lady for a year or two, Shirley is not likely to be so agreeable in the property split. She'd very likely hire a ball-busting attorney. And prenup or no, I would be in serious trouble. So I'm not dating any 27-year-old strippers. Are you, Mike?
No, I'm not. Was it terribly unromantic to negotiate these terms?
Was it unromantic? Yeah, it was practical. We had both been married and divorced before, and we both were kind of unsure how long we could make it last, and so we didn't know, so we were trying to be sensible about it. We are quite different. She is quite religious, and I'm not. I'm very much mathematically and gambling oriented, and she's not, but somehow it's worked, and it's been the best thing that ever happened to me. Like when Stanford Wong, when I was working for him briefly back in the early 90s, I was living with a Chinese woman who was very suitable in all respects. That didn't work out. It could have, but it didn't. And so I just didn't know how long the next one would, because I never started one of these relationships without expecting it to be forever and ever, amen. They just haven't worked out that way. But speaking of Stanford, he is on the line. Why don't you tell us about him, Michael?
Of the many books by Stanford Juan on my shelf, the most worn is Sharp Sports Betting. By far the most lucrative area when it has come to advantage play in my life, and I've tried lots of them, has been sports betting. And Stanford's book has been like my Bible, pointing me in the right direction. While most books on sports betting take the angle of how to handicap, the thrust of Sharp Sports Betting is how to make money at sports betting without handicapping. Everything is explained in easy-to-understand languages, and the strategies are simple to follow. So here to talk about how to make money at Sharp Sports Betting is the easy way is Stanford Wong. Stanford, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Well, thank you very much. And I wouldn't quite characterize the book the way you did. I would say that Sharp Sports Betting explains the logic behind it, explains the mathematics. And I'm really not that good a handicapper myself. I can't really talk about handicapping if I don't know how to do it. But I do understand the mathematics of it. For example, with prop bets, if you've got something that says something is supposed to happen more than or less than six times, you can bet on that. Why, I can work out the mathematics that if you have an idea for the distribution, I can tell you whether you should bet more or less or none of the above.
Well, most of the chapters in your book, according to my interpretation, you didn't need to handicap at all. And personally, I do absolutely zero handicapping. I leave that to other people. But my opinion, and I know some people strongly disagree, is that the market is pretty efficient and that the point spread and the total get pounded to around where they should be. And then I use that information to exploit other more exotic bets.
I think that's a very good way to do it. And as far as efficiency of the market, that's basically my attitude also. When new information becomes available, you better act on it quickly, because if you delay it all, why, the lines makers are going to get access to that same information and figure it into the spread. Injury, for example. If you read in the news that some player's been injured, well, I'm sorry, but that's too late to be able to capitalize on it with a bet. If you're watching a practice and you see the player get injured, you better call and make a bet right away, because as soon as that moves gets out, the line's going to move.
And was that a main angle when you were more actively betting sports?
When I was more actively betting it, the main expertise that I personally had was to be able to find situations where the public was making a mistake, where most of the money that was coming in for maybe emotional reasons. The best example I can think of is we had one NBA final where it was Los Angeles Lakers against Detroit Pistons. And Los Angeles is a lot closer to Las Vegas than Detroit is. There's a lot more money in Los Angeles than there is in Detroit. Los Angeles Lakers were, I think they were probably defending champions maybe multiple times. Anyway, they had the reputation, and they were legitimately the favorite in the finals. But all the money was coming in on Los Angeles, and so that meant Detroit a good bet, not because I thought Detroit was going to win, but because I thought Los Angeles was just being way, way overbet, and so I bet on Detroit.
So when it comes to injuries, and I agree that I try to keep my finger on the pulse of that, but I've never believed that that alone was enough to overcome the juice, so it's always been part of my equation. But when it comes to injuries, if you see an injury in a game, do you have somebody you can call, or do you make a bet online to immediately capitalize on that information and try to beat the rush?
You know, I personally don't. I have never made a bet online, for example. When I first got into sports betting, I talked with a lot of people while I was gathering information. And what I found was that, and I forgot now whether it's Justice Department or Internal Revenue or what, but somebody was kind of leaning on high-profile people who were betting on the Internet. And so I decided that I just didn't need that kind of hassle in my life. I get to Las Vegas often enough. If I want to bet sports, I can go to Las Vegas. But I bet only in Las Vegas, and that's it.
Okay.
When you wrote the book, you published each chapter on your website, bj21.com. You got lots of good feedback, which made for a better book. At the same time, you cost yourself quite a bit of money because many of the people who have otherwise purchased the book now didn't buy it because they had it for free. Overall, do you think this trade-off worked in your favor or against you?
You know, I've done this with every book that I've ever written, is I've always tried to get as many people to read over drafts of it before the thing is published as I can, you know, experts in the field or people that are good at grammar, you know, good at handling the English language. I want, when that book comes out, that it's a finished product, that it's been gone over by numerous people and it's as good as I can make it. Of course, I'll still be able to come up with revisions in the future, but, you know, I just don't want to put something out that's kind of half-baked. If I'm going to make a mistake when I'm writing it, let some expert catch my mistake, and you know, that way I only look like a fool in the eyes of that one expert. I don't look like a fool in the eyes of everybody that bought the book.
All right, I guess so that means you think you benefited greatly by giving it, by letting everybody see it first.
Well, you know, at the time that book came out, there really was no decent sports betting book other than that, and what I really wanted to do was publish a book on sports betting. And all the people who were experts in the field, I approached them and said, would you please write a book? I'll publish it. And they'd all say, nope, I don't want to give away my secrets. I'm not going to write a book. And so I decided, well, I guess I could write one myself. There's other people more qualified to write a book on sports betting than me, but you know, I can at least write what I'm good at and seek other people's input to, in the areas where I am weak, and that's what happened.
And this is a little unrelated, but one of the better ideas I think that I've had was, before I publish a new page on my Wizard of Odds site, I ask my forum members on my Wizard of Vegas site, which is much smaller, to preview it. And they're very good at catching both mathematical errors and typographical errors. So they will give everything a good once-over before I actually publish it to a larger audience. And I also mentioned this, that if any of my followers want to see anything new in advance, I always announce it on my Vegas site first. And, you know, much like you, I like to be as accurate as possible.
It's not just accuracy. It's not just catching errors. It's also when you're trying to explain something complicated, your explanation has to be understandable. It has to be, well, like Einstein said, everything should be as simple as possible, but no simpler. Well, there may be a way that you can reword your argument, put the last paragraph first or something to make, you know, all the same logic and everything, but make it easier to understand. And that's the sort of thing where you need fresh eyes looking at your material, people that know it, but, you know, they can say, you know, it's a little bit confusing the way you've written it. If you just put this idea first and this idea last, then it'll be clearer, and you make the change and you say, yeah, it's a whole lot better now.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, my next question concerns teasers, and for the listeners that don't know what a teaser is, let me explain it. A teaser is something that's usually in football or basketball, and it's like a parlay card, except they move the point spread so many points in your favor. And the most common kind of football teaser is the 6-point teaser. So on every pick that you make, the point spread is going to be moved 6 points in your favor. For example, if you bet on what's normally a 2-point underdog, now, instead of getting 2 points, you get 8 points. But of course, nothing is ever free, and the pay table, or should I say the wins, if you do win, are a lot less than if you went off a straight parlay card. Now, one of the best chapters in your book, in my opinion, deals with teasers. And it correctly states that the most common margins of victory in the NFL are 3 points and 7 points. And if you can cross over both of those margins of victory in a teaser, for example, what I just said, moving from a 2-point underdog to 8 points, then if your team loses by either those 3 or 7 points, which is highly probable, you'll still cover that part of the teaser. And at the more liberal odds, for example, minus 110 for a 2-teaser, plus 180 for 3 teams, and plus 300 for a 4-teamer. According to your book, it was a strong advantage play. My question is, do you still believe that way? Have you updated your research on teasers since you wrote the book? And basically, how have those gone for teaser bettors since your book was published?
Well, I update that information every time I reprint the book, which is about once every 3 years or so. And I also updated it after last season to get the ebook out. You can get Sharp Betting as an ebook now, and I'm in the process of updating it to include the 2011 season, because I'm running out of inventory of paper, you know, of paper books. I'm going to have to come up with a new one there. But the problem right now with teasers is there's a proposed rule change in the NFL that might make us have to rework the whole teaser thing. What they're talking about doing is giving each team a chance to have the football on offense in overtime. So if a team is the first possession and it scores a field goal to go ahead by three, that may not be the end of the game. The other team may have a chance to get the ball and come back and try to score itself. And what that will happen if that rule change comes into effect is it might decrease the frequency of three-point difference at the end of the game. So that might change the teaser. It won't change the recommendation. You'll still try to tease to get the 3 and a 7, but it might affect the profitability of the 3.
That rule change already was implemented, wasn't it?
It was implemented in the playoffs last year.
Playoffs only, but they're talking about putting it in regular season because they like the idea. And so I don't know what's going to happen this coming season. You know, they haven't announced rule changes for this coming season yet. So anyway, if there is no rule change there, then we can say that teasers have continued to perform as well in recent years as they did, in the first issue of the book that came out.
Now, you give a lot of data in your book about what happened. Now, in the version I have, it talked about data from 1990 to 2000, and yes, apparently you've updated that. Where do you get all this data? Is this if you have all this data, I would think you could be a lot better handicapper. Where does one get the data that you've used in your book?
There's several places to get it. The easiest way for me to do it, to get in the form that I need, is from the goal sheet, because I can download all regular season games and all playoff games. I've got the lines, the spreads, the scores, and it's easy enough for me to convert that into Excel, and then I can check it every which way. There's occasionally times when I've found mistakes in there, for example, where they'll have a wrong score or something. So then I just send an email to the goal sheet people and say, hey, check such and such a game, and then I get a thank you email saying, yes, thank you very much for correcting that error. but there's probably other places too. I mean, there are probably sources available, but once I find one that is in a format that I can use and does a job for me and it's reliable, I've never had a situation where I thought the goal sheet data was totally wrong. I mean, it's just sometimes, maybe the score was 14-7 and they'll put 14-7 in both places instead of 7-14 and for the other team. But they've never made a mistake that was, bigger than that. So anyway, that's what I use the goal sheet.
I've used the goal sheet too for some other sports, and I've found that there was that everything was off by one field or something, and I had to write scripts to clean up their data, and it was very time consuming and frustrating. And for the NFL, I use a source called Mr. NFL, which sells a spreadsheet that has all kinds of statistics for every game. And I've found that to be the price to be well worth it.
I will check into Mr. NFL because that might save me a couple of days worth of work.
Okay. Speaking of teasers, I heard that Steve Fezzik published a strategy about crossing the 3 and 7 before you did. And I hear that he bristles when people refer to them as Wong teasers. Do you know if that's true?
Well, that's a complicated area. In the first place, I'm not the first person that came up with the idea of getting the 3 and the 7. I just put it in my book. It was general knowledge at the time I put it in my book, and I shouldn't be getting credit for inventing something new I didn't. In terms of Steve Fezzik publishing it earlier, I do have a couple of dozen references listed of things that I learned from before I put my book together, and I've never seen a publication by Steve Fezzik. I've never seen a book by him. I don't think he has a book out. I've never seen an article by him. I know he's had some posts on the internet. It's very possible that he said something about teasers before I did, because a whole lot of people said something about the teasing for the 3 and a 7 before I did. But in terms of whether specifically Steve did, I don't know. And I think it's kind of funny because I know Steve Fezzik. I see him, I would say, in the year 2011, I probably ran into him at least a dozen times. And if there was something that I did that, especially something here that's correctable, I mean, I'm always reprinting the book. I can put in something that says, you know, give credit where credit is due. He's never mentioned it.
Okay.
So I don't really know what to make of that. Next time I see him, I will ask him. And if credit is appropriate, I mean, I do believe in giving credit where credit is due, but I have to know that it's due in order to give credit for it.
Well, speaking of people using your name for things that you brought up in your books, one of the most common terms in blackjack is wonging into a game when the count is good. Do you proudly take credit that people call it that? Because I have a feeling people were doing that before you wrote about it.
They were doing it before I knew about it. In fact, that was the way that I met counters in the early day, because it was quite a common tactic. And when I would be at a casino walking around with my handful of black chips, and I would occasionally stumble across the game where there was somebody else who was betting black chips too, I'd kind of look at him. He'd look like me, at me like, hey, I know what you're doing. And we'd get together and have lunch or something. So I did not invent that. It did not have a name. In fact, I didn't even call it wonging in professional blackjack when I first explained it. I just explained it as, here's a tactic that works. And it was actually, it was customers in Atlantic City. When Atlantic City first opened Resorts International there, they started calling it wonging, and they taught me the name. So, you know, when I reprinted professional blackjack, I put it in there. But I did not invent it. I think it's kind of humorous. But, you know, I can only take credit for publicizing and not inventing it.
Well, it's good. It's good that all kinds of things they could call wonging. It's good that it's something positive. Now the Olympics are coming up this summer in London. Now, I'm not sure if Vegas casinos allow betting on the Olympics, but if they did, would you generally recommend betting against the Americans? Simply because most of the bettors of these props are going to be Americans. If the basketball team should be favored by, say, 12 points against some country, then the line probably in the books is going to be 15, because people just can't be unpatriotic and bet for the other guy. Would you think this would happen, or am I making too much of this?
Well, it's a complicated situation. First place, in terms of what bets are allowed in Nevada, Nevada does not allow betting on sports with judges. So things like figure skating, you won't be able to bet those in Nevada unless they've changed the rules since last time I saw them. But things like who wins the Olympic basketball competition, you should be able to bet. But in terms of betting against the Americans, you know, Las Vegas doesn't set the lines anymore. It's all done on the Internet. And in terms of people who are very knowledgeable, who are the skillful bettors who set the lines, those are not necessarily Americans. I mean, there's people, you know, even small countries of the world like Greece that has some very knowledgeable players, that the lines makers are more likely to look to those big Greek bettors than they are to the masses of Americans. Americans may bet more money, but that doesn't mean that it's smarter money. So I don't know if you can just automatically bet against the Americans and have a positive EV. I really kind of doubt you can do it anymore. There probably was a time when you could do that.
Okay, so we're in the March Madness right now. And to go back a little bit, I didn't know that you're updating your book every 3 years. I still have this old copy from 2001 in front of me. But one thing that I tried was your March Madness props. And for the benefit of the listeners, what Stanford does is he gives an expected number of wins according to the seed of each team. And so if you have a prop like how many games will the Pac-10 win, you just add up this power rating for each team in the Pac-10 that's in the conference, and that'll give you a number, and you use that to go against the line. And I did that for 4 or 5 seasons, and to be honest, I think that I'm probably a small loser at it. So my question is do you still have that chapter in the more recent books, and have the expected number of wins changed?
The chapter's still in the books. In terms of betting on March Madness, it's been a few years since I bet on it myself, but the mathematics is still solid. The reason that chapter is in there is because when you have that structure of, you know, that format of 16 teams per division, and number one plays number 16, and number two plays number 15, and so on. That's just a very strong format in terms of likelihood of advancing. You know, the number one seed still has never lost in the first round. It probably should have lost maybe once or one and a half times in, with all the games they've played. And the number two team, you know, lost twice this year, but it's very unusual. Anyway, if you apply probabilities on advancing, the easiest one to understand is when the number eight team plays the number nine. One of those has to win. You've got two teams that are fairly evenly matched. Putting 0.55, you know, each one is 0.5 of winning is if you don't know anything else about the teams, that's a pretty good handle for the first game. And then for the second game, whoever wins that first one is going to be up against number one, and it's going to get clobbered. I mean, you know, what number would you put on a number eight seed for total wins on a tournament except for half a game? And same thing for number nine, half a game. It's not going to suddenly jump to seven-tenths of a game.
Okay.
Well, yeah, but it would. It would. There are times that a number eight seed beats a number one seed. So...
Right. Slightly over 0.5.
Yeah, so it definitely goes up. I mean, they are in the game. You do have the Norfolks winning occasionally. But, you know, VCU last year went to the Final Four.
Yeah.
So it has to go up.
Anybody that uses that chapter of the book and loses, especially loses big, it's because of variance. And same thing if you won big. If you approximately break even or if you won a little bit, that's what your expectation is in that neighborhood. And I haven't seen Mr. Shackelford's spreadsheet or anything, but I would guess that he was a victim of, you know, being on the left side of the curve in terms of luck, you know, net unlucky.
Well, some people that I've talked to about this say that that your averages are correct, but you can't necessarily say in any given season that a number 7 seed, for example, is better than a number 10 seed. It may be because of different conferences or whatnot, and that...
Actually, that could very well be that you can improve on that. We had a situation this year, for example, where in the first round it was San Diego State against North Carolina State, and San Diego State had the higher ranking in the tournament. I think they were number 6, and they were not the favorite in that first game.
Yes.
North Carolina State was something like a 3.5-point favorite, even though San Diego had the higher ranking in the tournament. Now, that's an instance where the rankings in the book would have given you inferior information. You should have flipped those around, I guess, and whatever is number 6 seed, you know, give that to North Carolina State. Don't give it to San Diego State for that particular game.
Yep.
But if you don't know that kind of information yourself, do you think that your strategy in your book is still solid enough to make money?
I would say yes, but I would qualify it to say you can't just pick tiny differences. If the book says your conference is supposed to win average of 2.3 games and you've got a prop that you need 2.4 to make your bet worthwhile, that's not a big enough difference to go put real money on. But if the book says 2.3 and you find something that's the break-even point is 3, then, you know, that's a big enough difference. Even if a book is off a little bit on certain games, why, you still have a big edge.
And I follow that advice with all exotic bets with sports, is I like to have a comfortable margin of error before I'll even make a bet. Like, I like to perceive at least a 5% advantage, whereas in video poker, I'm happy to make a bet with a 0.5% advantage.
Well, the difference is in video poker, you know what your advantage is precisely, whereas on betting sports, you have only an approximate knowledge of what the number should be, and there probably, in fact for sure, there are people out there with more information about you, and they have a better handle on that game than you do. And if you think the line is off, it's not that the line is off, it's that you don't know what all information went into making that line. And if you knew the rest of the story, then you'd realize that the line is where it should be.
Absolutely.
And since video poker is my field, I want to say That's not entirely true. You can know what the game is worth and the slot club's worth, but if it includes such things as drawings and mailers and other promotions, frequently you have to make a guesstimate as to what those are worth. But still, you do have better information in video poker in generally. Many of our listeners have no handicapping skills, and including the guy on the microphone now. And we're not planning on obtaining a lot of these skills. But sometimes you like to bet, say, $20 on a televised game just because the game, they think the game's more interesting to watch if you got something riding on it. Now, are there some basic strategy for betting that if you were going to bet $20 and a game you really know nothing about, which should you do it for the least EV against you?
I would say bet just to have fun. Bet on the team that you feel like rooting for. You know, the big problem with sports betting is something that hasn't been mentioned yet tonight, and that's an unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act. What that did, that was the law that Congress passed that made it illegal for credit card companies to process gambling transactions and a bunch of other related stuff. And what that did was it basically took a lot of the weak players out of the sports betting game. It's like you're playing poker in a game, and all of a sudden a whistle blows, and the weakest players get up and leave, and you're still playing in a game, but you look around the table, and only the strong players are left. Well, the equivalent of that happened to sports betting back when that unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act was passed, and it's really much more difficult to make money at sports betting now than it was before that.
I agree 100%. I found it much more difficult to find good props online since that happened.
Well, or even good props in the casinos themselves.
I think that that might be for a different reason, but I think that there's more people exploiting weak props on the Super Bowl now than there used to be.
Now, Chapter 12 of your book deals with the home field advantage in the NFL. Now, everyone agrees there's a home field advantage, but there's a lot of different opinions as to why. You said in your book that it's worth 3 points on average, but it varies from game to game. And exploiting strong and weak home field advantages was something you do. However, you tease the reader by not really telling us how you do that. So what?
Well, at the time I put the book together, it was something I was working on. And I didn't explain any more because I didn't have anything that I had developed to the point where it was worth explaining. And it turned out to be something that I worked on and never could get a handle on. And in fact, there's some recent material on that. There's a book called Scorecasting, which I'm sure you guys know about, that sort of makes it sound like it's referees are the ones that give the home team that extra edge. And they don't do it because they're trying to be devious or not trying to, they're not intentional. It's just they're reacting to crowd noise. They're just more likely to make calls that favor the home team. And you can actually see that when you're watching a game, especially an NFL game. There will be something that you say, well, that looks like a call that could go either way. I'll bet it goes for the home team. And you wait, and they make the call, and sure enough, it goes for the home team. So I think if I were to rewrite that chapter, I would say, yes, there's a home field advantage because the crowd is rooting for the home team, and the referees and all are reacting to crowd noise and calling the game accordingly.
Well, I was going to ask you about that book in my next question, but you already bring it up.
I think it's an excellent book. Anybody interested in sports betting should read that.
I absolutely agree. It's one of the best books about gambling I've read.
Tobias Moskowitz and L. John Wertheim.
Okay, but one thing in the book is that they mentioned is with making free throws in basketball, they said that the statistics are almost the same whether it's the home team or the away team making the free throw.
Making free throws, yes, but not calling fouls.
Exactly. That's a good point. So the way I interpreted the book is they keep talking about how money influences sports over and over. And my interpretation is that if the crowd leaves happy, they're more likely to come back again, buying another ticket, ultimately driving up ticket prices. And it's that force that perhaps subconsciously is causing the referees to make calls the home team's way.
You know, that may not necessarily be true. And the reason is that you find a home field advantage even in things where you don't have big money involved. There's home field advantage in high school football, for example, where there's, that's not a money-making thing. That's for the kids to go out and have a good experience, have some fun. And yet the referees in high school football are still reacting to crowd noises and making decisions that favor the home team. So I don't really think it's dollar driven. I think it's just the way the human brain works. Is, you know, there's nothing crooked about it whatsoever. It's just that's the way it is.
Good point.
I always thought that the purpose of a sports book is to balance the bets on both sides. If you can get somebody betting on the Packers and paying 11 to 10 and get the same amount of money bet on the Saints at 11 to 10, then the sports book is guaranteed a 1 out of 21 profit. In your book, you indicate that that's not really the case to balance the books. Can you explain this on why you think that?
Well, there's a couple things involved. One is that the sports books, they run it differently. It's not pari-mutuel like horse racing. You know, in horse racing, you go bet on a horse. You do not know what kind of odds you are going to get until the bell rings when the horses go off, and then you find, oh, I guess I'm going to get 4-1 if my horse wins. But maybe at the time you bet the horse, you thought it was going to be 6-1 or 10-1 or something. You don't know 4-1 until it's too late. You've already bet your money. But sports betting doesn't work that way. If you're getting +3 on a team, you lock that +3 in. And at the time the sports book is taking your bet, it doesn't know how much money is going to come on your team, and it doesn't know how much money is going to come in on the other team. So the idea of something that's going to split the action when they don't know what the action is going to be, let, you know, they can do it approximately, but they certainly can't do it exactly like horse racing. But the other thing, you know, sports books are trying to make money. Suppose that you are running a sports book of your own,
uh-huh,
and you know that your clientele is primarily going to be favoring a certain team. Do you really want to have something that's just going to split the money, or are you going to want to say, well, if everybody's going to bet on the Packers anyway, let's nudge the line a half a point or so and make those people pay a little bit extra for the fact that we know ahead of time they like the Packers? That only seems like a logical thing to do, but that's anything I've seen in terms of writing about what people that make lines actually do, or talking to people myself. Why, you know, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to maximize profits. They're just not trying to lock in a particular amount of profit. They want to make as much money as they can, and this is one way to do it. If you know your customers favor a certain team, you set the line accordingly. There are some books on sports betting where they talk about, you know, bookies, where the people the book writes about is people who are making bets, accepting bets from their neighbors and stuff, and they're all doing that.
Ultimately, the sports book director, though, has to answer to higher management in the casino, and despite being in the gambling business, it's my opinion that casinos don't like gambling. They like to just make consistent money on a day-to-day basis. And I could imagine that if a sports book director had the philosophy to try to maximize long-term profit, it would be at the cost of occasionally losing on some games. And he may not want to get called into the conference room and ask, why did we lose money on this game? Do you think that under that pressure, he might have more of a philosophy to balance the action on every game and try to win money every single week?
Not every game is the same. If you're talking about Super Bowl, definitely you want to balance the action, because if you take a stand and everybody comes in, you know, you might take just a huge amount of action on one side and not the other. In fact, that wiped out one internet sports book a few years ago. I forgot the name of it, but I think they were having financial difficulties ahead of time, and so they decided to take a stand that St. Louis was going to beat New England, so they gave a line that brought in a lot of money on St. Louis. And then when New England won the Super Bowl that year, covered the spread, why that sports book got wiped out. That's the exception, though. That's not usually what happens. But say your typical run-of-the-mill baseball game or NBA game or something, you're not going to have one game that overwhelms the other games of the day to the point where you're going to show a loss if that one game goes the wrong way. And all the other books are doing the same thing. If everybody else has a team is +7, you're probably going to want to have them +7 too, even if you know the sport well enough to say, well, it really should be +6. The only reason it's +7 is because we know most of the bettors are going to want to favor a certain side. You're still going to go along with the same +7 that everybody else has. You're not going to go with +6 because you think that's, you know, really the proper line.
Do we have time for another question?
I think not. If you want to make it quick.
Well, we'll try.
Okay.
In your chapter 14, you give a probability of winning and fair money line for spreads of -3 to +3. How come you don't go beyond that tight range?
You know, from +3 to -3, there are an awful lot of data points. You can make predictions and be very confident those predictions are going to handle future years, absent a big rule change. And what I do for spreads beyond that is I give a table in there, I forgot what table it is, 22, I think, that says how frequently teams of different spreads have covered the spread, have won outright. So you can look at that and say, well, if a team is a 7-point favorite, for example, they've won 3/4 the time in the past, does that mean they really should be -300? I'm not going to tell you it's -300. I'll just let you look at the data and say, well, that's what's done it in the past.
Well, there's only so many NFL games in a season, but do you think that it might be a service to your readers if you looked at all the data and tried to smooth it all out, taking under consideration the significant point spreads and putting a specific fair money line for all the different spreads rather than asking the reader to look at a big table of data and do it himself?
You know, the reader can look at what's actually being offered in the book and can see what's what money lines are associated with spreads at different, for various games. And the reader can certainly look at a situation and say, well, if the point spread has just changed, let me glance at the money line, because if the money line hasn't been changed yet, then even though the point spread has changed, maybe I'm better off betting the money line than, the opposite team of what's been favored in the line change. That's one of those areas where if I put numbers on it, I stand a chance of giving people advice that's going to turn out to be bad a couple years from now, because I'd be making numbers looking at data that was available to me at the time I made them, and yet those numbers would still be, information people would use in the future, even if they're no longer, quite explaining the games that have been played since I wrote the numbers down.
And I can attest to that lots of times if there's a sudden line movement, say due to an injury, lots of times people will ignore the money line and that will stay the same, which is a good good advantage play. So thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Hey, it was fun.
Good. We'll try it again. All right. Michael, what did we learn?
I learned, what did I learn? Let me compose myself here.
I learned about the rules in the Olympics. I didn't know that how limited it was in betting on the Olympics and what you could and couldn't do.
Yeah, I've never seen bets on the Olympics before. I thought the rule was that you couldn't bet on amateur sports in the sports books here, but then you might call college sports amateur sports. So I don't know why there's an exception for that.
Nobody with any kind of knowledge would call college football an amateur sport.
Well, it's supposed to be.
Uh-huh. Tell that to USC and Ohio State and all the others.
Don't think they're going to listen.
So what's happening at thewizardofodds.com and your adjacent sites, your other sites?
Well, thank you for asking. Let me put in a quick plug, by the way, for New Vision Cyclery in Summerlin. I'm big into biking, and they always take care of my bikes, and they always do it at a very reasonable price. And every time I go in there, I always have a very interesting chat with the owner, Danny, about anything. You can bring up any topic you want, and it seems like he's an expert on it, and he's always fun to chat with. But on the Wizard of Odds, I just released another math analysis of a slot machine. I played a game called Hex Breaker for about half an hour at the Main Street Station and recorded all of it, and then I hired someone to record every single spin. And then once he did this, and I had it all in a spreadsheet, I did all the math on this game and to calculate how it was designed and what are the odds of everything happening. And so this took a lot of time, so I'm very proud to now lift the veil in front of another slot machine to try to explain to the readers out there how they actually work. And here's another example. I also released a page on a game Keno game called Caveman Keno Plus, which involves bonus balls and multipliers. Nothing new on the Wizard of Vegas, and at Wizard of Macau, my field agent over there, James Kay, just published a review of the Taipa Square Casino.
Very good. South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else. They're having a food promotion this month, Mondays through Thursdays. Play 300 points, earn a free lunch buffet. 600 points, earn a free dinner buffet. The Palms, the play, earn, and win promotion, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, gives you things for the office, such as a wireless printer, a paper shredder, a clock safe. Keep the points. This is their way of doing double points. There's going to be a 2012 Jeep Patriot given away every Friday night, excuse me, every Saturday night at 7 p.m. You earn entries by playing. 10 people are chosen on Friday night to get $500 and a key into the Jeep drawing, and 10 more people are Saturday night to get a key into the Jeep drawing, and then Saturday after the regular drawing, one key works. At videopoker.com, the free tournament starts tomorrow. It'll be triple play, and it runs until the end of the month. The grand prize is airfare to Las Vegas, three nights in a suite at the MGM Signature, and free entry into a charity tournament that benefits Opportunity Village. That tournament is on April 7th and includes a first prize of a $10,000 seat in the main event of next year's World Series of Poker. If you don't win your way into the April 7th tournament, entries cost $300, which includes VIP brunch for you and a guest inside the Pure nightclub. Opportunity Village serves people with intellectual disabilities. The Opportunity Village charity tournament is hosted by videopoker.com. Next week, we're having Michael Gaughan as a guest on the show. We've actually already taped that, or we taped it last Friday, because next week, both Shaq and I are otherwise occupied on Thursday night. So you'll hear that on Thursday night as though it were live. As a player there, I found a lot of his comments to be very forthright. I'm more attuned to what's happening at South Point than almost anybody, because I do occasionally talk to Mr. Gaughan, and I learned some things from that interview. So I recommend you tune in. After the show, so we were in the microphone, Gaughan, Shackelford, and me, just shooting the bull about a variety of subjects. And one of the things that came up is security cameras at the South Point. Like for their valet, they photograph the car on all four sides as it goes in. So if somebody claims a car got dinged in the parking lot, well, they have evidence as to whether it did or didn't. Mr. Gaughan invited both Shaq and me to take a tour of their surveillance room sometime in early April and report back on this show. And I don't know, it might show up on the Wizard of Vegas, or may show up on one of my Tuesday blogs. That actually fascinates me to see in the security room.
I'm really looking forward to that. I've never seen a security room either.
So I don't know if we're going to play a few hands on a machine to see if you can see what's being played. I don't know how we're going to test it, but we'll work that out. And it's always nice to know what a casino can see and can't see.
Absolutely, and we'll report to the audience all about that after we do it.
Very good. So one of the things, so we won't get into that. Hope you hit lots of royal flushes. We'll see you next week.
See you next week, everyone.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel Casino and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.